They want me to get rid of my dog. Can they do that?
I'm being fined for leaving my garage door open too long.
What are covenants? Do I have any rights?
Help, I feel like I've left the American zone.
If you want the answers to those questions, join me, Shu Bartholomew, and my guests on The Commons every Saturday from 2 to 3 right here on WEBR Fairfax Radio. We'll ask the experts and we'll untangle the truth about what's left of our property rights. On the Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory membership homeowners associations. Join us as we explore this relatively new world of controlled living, which includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single-family homes. Living in a common ownership development means giving up the American dream. It means giving up your constitutional rights and control over your most valuable asset, your home. Living in a homeowners association means leaving the American zone. This is On the Commons, and I am Shu Bartholomew.
Have you ever bought a book by the pound? Well, I just did, and it weighs 8 pounds. I mean, that's took longer to write than it does to have a baby, right?
I figure I probably earned about maybe 3 cents, perhaps 10 cents on the hour, well, amassing all the information that went into this book.
Well, joining us today, please let me introduce my guests. My guest is called Carolyn Douglas, and she has written a book, and it's amazing, and with winter coming on, I'm going to curl up and read it. It's called The Dark Side, A Law Treatise on Judging, along with memoirs, so you get to know a little bit about her as well. Carolyn, thank you so much for driving in, coming into the studio, and joining me here today.
Oh, it's delightful. I'm always happy to meet with you, Shu.
Well, I'm excited, too, because I think I've just made a new friend. And as I said, I'm looking forward to sitting down this winter when it's cold and I can't run around and climb all over the place, to sitting down and just being able to read through it. But we do talk a lot about judges and court cases and attorneys and all kinds of issues and problems. I'm fortunate I've never been on the receiving end of any of that. What's it like? But I hear from people who have, and it's like they've been through the ringer.
I'd say you've been blessed, Shu.
So
absolutely
far.
Blessed so far, knock on wood.
So far, so good.
My question to you is, why do you want a law treatise? A law treatise is usually something that judges buy or attorneys buy. I'm an experienced law treatise writer for half a dozen of, some of them are gone, the former law treatise publishers. LexisNexis is one, Reed Elsevier is another, Butterworth, Equity, Thompson. And I wrote books on family law for about 25 years. This book is an out-of-box thinking book, and it focuses on judge ethics and judge actions and judge treatment. And I wrote it for people who walk out of the courtroom and say, what the heck just happened in there? You know, I've spent $100,000 on legal fees, or I've spent whatever amount it is. The result is disastrous. It's taken over my life. I feel like I have ulcers. I've just lost everything. What happened? So since you haven't had that experience personally, Shu, why would you be interested in a law treatise?
Well, I haven't had that experience personally, but I talk to so many people who have. So many people who call me, who write to me, who are really, really confused, upset, out of tons and tons of money. The stories I hear, Carolyn, are enough to make your hair curl. It's horrible. Whatever's going on out there is horrible. I'm not an attorney. I cannot give legal advice. I try to find people and point people in the right direction. I can't help you, but believe it or not, I even hear from attorneys who
I do believe that. I do believe, as a former attorney, I didn't realize what I was going through, and so much of my experience as a litigator and in trial, I primarily did family law, all kinds of family law, and divorce law. You have so much respect for judges that when they say or do something that doesn't make sense
mm-hmm.
or isn't logical, or you're a bright person, you've done research, you're going into court, you've assembled all of your documents, you've made notebooks, you have beautiful notebooks, actually. You've got 3-ring binders, you've presented it to your attorney, who may or may not use it.
Yeah.
But you also are an intelligent person, and you're thinking, what happened in there shouldn't have happened. It doesn't feel fair.
Yeah.
The stories that you've heard, I mean, you've been, how many years have you been on air?
On air, this is my 17th year on this show, but this is my third show. So I've been around for a while, but I was around even before that. And one of my closest friends was an attorney who, I learned a lot from Fred. He's the late Fred Goldbecker. And I learned a whole lot from him, and I would work with his clients.
Well, I think you're part psychologist besides that. I like to laugh,
so we just release some tension that way, yeah.
I also do not give legal advice. I'm not a practicing attorney. I have 20 years experience in law, and I came into law late after a divorce that didn't make a lot of sense, but it was far away. And it was on the other side of the country, and I thought, oh, it was by an ethnic judge who I thought showed prejudice. And so I just sucked it up, went on to law school. But I focused on family law all the way through law school. Then I moved to New Hampshire. My first job was writing bills for the state legislature. And I was assigned certain areas to write. I wrote bills for occupational regulation. Now, I'm an older law student, law graduate, but I'm still, this is my first job, and I'm overcompensating perhaps, and I'm doing a lot of work. I think I wrote 176 bills that first year. I spent a lot of overtime hours. I was the only one in the office. It's 10 o'clock at night, and I'm still writing laws that are now regulating estheticians and land surveyors and others. So I learned a lot about how in one small little state, we had what I now recognize as creeping regulation, where we're regulating yeah. things that didn't used to be regulated.
Yeah.
Morticians. I'm not saying, and I don't in my book, I don't say whether this is right or wrong. I'm simply commenting on the development of regulation in American life.
Yeah.
And this was in the 80s when regulation went wild in America. I mean, the exponential growth of laws and new courts and new systems and new bureaucracy wasn't just on the federal level. It was on the state level, but I saw it because I was writing this. About that time, I met my second husband, who was a sitting U.S. congressman. He had been a former state Supreme Court judge. He sat on the bench with former David Souter of the U.S. Supreme Court. I mean, everybody there was active in politics and moved on to other things. New Hampshire does politics really well. It's like the state
the
sport.
First state, right?
First in the nation, state yeah. sport. But I can remember having a discussion with him about why lawyers suddenly, in the 80s, why they ceased being regulated by the state, like every other occupation out there. They ceased being regulated by the state, and now we're being regulated by
the
judges. Not the bar.
Not the bar.
The judges.
Oh.
The judges assume control, as they said, the third branch of government. So they assume control over all lawyers.
Oh.
But what they did is they delegated their authority largely to the trade association called the bar. So here we have a private trade association that's receiving a lot of power, but not legally, in my opinion. And I can remember one of the very first heated discussions that my to-be husband and I had was why that was proper, why attorneys weren't regulated like doctors and everybody else in the state, why they weren't regulated by the state legislature. That was at the beginning of my attorney law career, and that actually was at the end of my law career. I had the same question. I've been in law for about 25 years, but I stopped practicing when I became a whistleblower about the court and the bar system. in the mid-1990s. I did a lot of education. I believe that educated people on especially complicated areas like law are the best resource America has for overcoming corruption, for understanding what's happening. Instead of turning it over to our legislators or our senators, and I'd like to talk about the U.S. Senate because they are the ultimate supervisor of judges and problems with court and problems with judges, and I'd like to end up with that, but to work into it backwards. I wrote this heavy book.
It is heavy.
It's a law treatise, and I didn't write it for judges. This time I wrote it for ordinary people. And I wrote it because I, like you, 17 years ago, was contacted by hundreds, if not thousands, of people from across the country when I started doing this whistleblowing. And it stemmed from an inadvertent meeting on the street with an Associated Press reporter who approached me and wanted to know what was happening in my divorce from the former congressman. This was years later, after we had practiced law together and we had done retail politics together, and I had learned so much about both state and national politics, grassroots organization, organizing an entire state for a presidential campaign, not just one but several, following the rule book for candidates running for Congress. Both the parties have schools where people running for Congress can go almost no cost to their schools, but it's pretty quiet. You know, you have to know your way around these systems, and then they put you in touch with things. But we did retail politics as both a hobby and an advocation while we both practiced law. When I went through my divorce, I found so many things were happening in court that didn't follow the state statutes, they didn't follow the rule book, they didn't follow anything that I expected. And I was a premier divorce attorney in this small state. I mean, that's not bragging. It was a small state and not many people did divorce, but I had written the treatise. I had rewritten my husband's earlier treatise. So both our names were on it, but I literally wrote thousands of pages. So this 800 page actually seems like a piker to me.
That's a heavy baby. I've been carrying it around.
What happened is people started contacting me as I became more vocal about what I saw was happening in the courts. For a good 5 months, I was such a good girl. I was a Girl Scout. So I saw a judge committing misconduct and not following the rules, not following the laws, doing all kinds of things that didn't make sense in the courtroom. But here I am, an educated legal writer and experienced practitioner. And I'm seeing this, and I started complaining. I went to his supervisor, nothing. I went to his supervisor's supervisor. I went to the chief judge. I went to the state governor. I actually, at one point, went to the FBI. I went to the U.S. Attorney's Office. Finally, I stopped being such a good girl, and I started going to the editors of papers. By then, as an attorney speaking out about corruption amongst judges, now what I see is a pattern of cronyism. People might not want to call favors to other people within the bar or within the judge system to be corruption. They want to call it cronyism. It's a matter of semantics. You know, yeah. What do you want to call it? But people started contacting me as they did you 17 years ago. And I started meeting with them, and I was almost pulled under the water. I was like a drowning swimmer trying to rescue someone who was standing on my head.
Yeah.
So one weekend, I contacted almost everybody across the country who had already contacted me for help. And I said, I'm having a meeting. If you want to come, we're going to Ringe, New Hampshire, to the Cathedral of the Pines, which is a beautiful outdoor church. Everybody pays their own way. It's low budget. 17 women from across the country came to the first meeting of the ex-wives of judges. And that was the beginning. The Associated Press found out about it. They wanted to come. They ran a piece. It went global. It even landed in London during the week of the American Bar Association conference. After that, I was just inundated, and I didn't know how to handle it. You know, that 15 minutes of fame. There was calls from Oprah and Barbara Walters and people, Dateline. I made some really stupid media decisions, more or less because people like the Washington Post literally landed on my doorstep at 7 in the morning and I opened it. And I was naive, even though I had been in broadcast. Yeah. You know, I didn't know how to handle that. But that was the beginning of this book, that first meeting of the ex-wives of judges. The ladies showed up, and I really didn't have a program. And they all sat around they were really complaining. They were complaining loudly about what had happened to them in their divorces. One of them was, they weren't just wives of judges from across the country. One of them was a wife of a former governor. One of them, wife of a movie star. One, Stan Getz, his former wife was there. I mean, there was a whole series of people, women who had been high profile. There was one man who was supposed to come from North Carolina, but he ended up not being able to come. So we're not gender biased or gender limiting. It can be any spouse. But what you find is that judges' spouses are almost always female. So the women sat around. We went to a restaurant. They still continued, they just continued to bitch. And I'm sitting there as the only lawyer in the group listening to this, getting a little frustrated with all the complaints, not knowing where this is going. We've spent money. We've expended our resources coming together, and we're all strangers. So we don't know each other. And all of a sudden, the gift I have from God is being able to see things from a bird's eye view. You're smiling, but
I am smiling.
It took me a long time to recognize that gift, that I'm able to take a series of small circumstances, complaints, grumbles, happenings, and look at it from an overview perspective. Mm-hmm. So I jumped up and grabbed an easel, and I started writing. Yeah. The women just kept complaining, and I'm writing, and I came up with a list of 29 topics that happened in almost every single one of our divorce cases, beginning with secrecy and sealing the records. None of us had recognized that. And as we went around the room and I said, let's talk about this topic. And we did that for the rest of the weekend. And those 29 similar instances became the first list for my first book, which was called Sneaky Judge Tricks. And it was supposed to be a cartoon book, like David Letterman, you know, Stupid Pet Tricks. Mm-hmm. And it was supposed to be a joke book. And I wrote it and I copywrote it and I didn't distribute it or bring it out broadly because I thought this is not a funny topic. This is not a joke. And for the next 10, almost 15 years, I gathered stories and research. At one point, I had almost 400 banker's boxes of research of different people's cases where I'm finding patterns, just like the ex-wives of judges. Once I developed that insight or that oversight, that gift where I got to look at cases where there's been some kind of internal abuse, either by the clerk of court or the bailiff or the judge or the attorneys, it allowed me to start thinking outside the box about how our court system operates. And the more research that I did, I realized, in the meantime, I picked up a couple of small, I did some chapters for Reed Elsevier on Washington family law. Each time I was hired to do these other research projects, I saw more and more patterns. I think this book is unique in America because in order to see these patterns, you need a legal education. They're very hidden. Often very hidden, but they're not complicated. So I divided it into 8 chapters, and I lead readers through the history of how the bar was formed state by state in all 50 states across the country from 1958 to 1982, and what that monopolistic takeover of the court of law, the rule of law, and the practice of law means on a practical level to American citizens. American citizens didn't even see it coming. It's like that regulation movement that happened in the 80s. Yeah. We didn't see all this regulation coming. I remember in New Mexico, where I ended up living for in a little ghost town for about 10 years, a lady was selling apricots from her tree by the side of the road. And I was so excited because I love to cook.
Uh-huh. Oh, cool.
I love to cook. I had a cooking show once. And I stopped and I bought 2 cases of apricots. And she threw in, being Hispanic, she threw in chilies. Really pretty.
Sounds like it's a yummy combination there.
Well, I went home and I made, maybe a dozen jars of apricot chili jam. Oh. And it was so good.
Oh, really?
Oh, I don't know. If you like habanero peppers.
Sounds a little hot for me.
They're so beautiful.
Yeah.
They're peach and yellow, and they're just gorgeous. But it wasn't that hot. And so a couple of days later, I went back to the lady to give her a jar of chili because she'd been so kind in giving me these peppers that I didn't know what to do with. And I couldn't find her. The stand was gone. Even the wooden stand was gone. I mean, I drove up and down these little side streets looking for this woman, and finally I knocked on the door of this little hacienda, little adobe, way back behind the horses. And I said, "What happened? I want more apricots. What did you do?" And she said, "They cited me. I didn't have a permit. I have to go to court." No. I'm lucky I wasn't arrested for selling fruits by the side of the road. I think this is so sad that in America we can't use our own land, sell our own products, even represent ourselves in court, help our neighbors, help our family, help the people we love without risking being arrested.
That was one of the hardest things I had to get used to when I came to the States from England, where I was a trained nurse, and when I got a job in America, we practiced cover your butt. It was not
taken. You didn't do that in England?
No, we didn't.
Cover your butt.
We covered our, well, I'm being polite. But, yeah. I mean,
but it means that you're holding back, that your God-given gifts that you can give and share and act in a loving way, you can't. You can't.
You know, we were trained to act and react under certain circumstances. And I remember somebody was choking, a very heavy patient was flat on her back, and I said to the other nurses in the room with me, "Help me flip her over on her side." They would not touch her without going and getting a doctor to say it's okay, but this is basic nursing. This is basic nursing care. So I flipped her over on my own. "Oh, you're going to get sued, really? Cool. And if she dies, chokes to death, then what?"
Well, I think it's become the mantra in America to sue.
Yeah.
There's so many lawsuits and people sue so freely.
Yeah.
But I wonder if they would sue less if they realize that there's a pattern to case outcomes where what seems to be happening in courts, from magistrate court, actually less in the traffic courts, but all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, there are patterns.
Yeah.
Not only the 29 elements that I heard from those women sitting around in a really lovely outdoor space, but women who were in pain.
Yeah.
Those patterns affect the ability of ordinary citizens to win in court. I see a pattern where it's designed to extend cases for years until the money's gone, till the assets are gone. Divorces or alternative ways of taking family apart are never even looked at or considered.
Yeah.
Mediation is not practiced generally in divorce court or other alternatives. I've been trained later as a mediator from Suffolk, and I've done children's court mediation, Navajo mediation, and Quaker mediation. It's a mediation process.
Quaker.
All these wonderful processes for solving disputes, whether it's within your family or within your community. And I love that whole process, but the bar systematically across the country doesn't really do much more than lip service to these processes because it takes fees from lawyers. or it puts lawyers in at a very expensive rate, and it seems like the monopolistic goal is not only to keep attorney prices high, but it becomes, courtrooms become a battle between to extend the process to feed the lawyers. So in something that I may be able to resolve in 4 hours or 8 hours in a controlled mediation process could be dragged out through lots of discovery and litigation and questions and production of documents to feed the lawyers. I used to say in divorce, you know, maybe we could settle this. Maybe we can find some resolution with you and your husband or your wife. You want to fight over the children or you want to fight over this asset, but let's put a dollar value on it and then figure out how much you're going to pay the lawyers and see if we can somehow save some money for you and for your children to go to college. Or perhaps you two don't want to get control of your emotions and you just want to fight each other. I was accused of that a lot, and yet I do understand that there's a dominant side often in divorce. Someone who's a bully, and if they tend to be a physical bully or a verbal bully or a psychological bully, what they end up doing if they have resources is they become a legal bully. So we end up, and I see these cases going, I've listened to some of your earlier shows, and I hear the same theme that I saw in divorce. It's not limited to court. It's a theme that covers the whole profession.
Yeah, it's the bullying. Since you mentioned my show, can we jump into my arena for just a second?
I'd love to.
With a lot of the homeowner issues, a lot of the cases that homeowners deal with, quite often there's this push to go to ADR. And what I find is that they're bullied there, and the records are sealed.
And the appeal rights are cut off.
Well, the other thing that I have a real hard time with is if you and I went to court and we came up with an agreement between the two of us, I'm going to pay you, you're going to pay me, whatever the deal is, and we agree to a gag order, that's fine. But I have a real hard time when we're dealing with using other people's money to cover the stupidity of the board that was needled by the association attorney, and the homeowners are not allowed to know what they're paid for.
The misuse of judicial processes, including gag orders and sealing and the ability to coerce the weaker party,
has
reached, I think, an epidemic in all different kinds of legal forums. What we're also seeing is there are now people are forced into forums that are non-constitutional forums. They're judge-made forums or like the Homeowners Association Forum or ADR, which is this Alternative Dispute Resolution. I have two different sections in my book where I actually analyze the makeup of ADR panels and the increased use of retired judges or old judges or other people who are vested in the system, and they're charging exorbitant fees. Yes. I mean, $700 an hour is not at all unusual. And the lawyers involved in the case, instead of representing their client's best interest and really fighting for their clients, may do that, but may often be more worried about what's going to happen to them and their bottom line and meeting their monthly budget and how much they can bill, and the trade-offs. What I found within the profession is there's so many trade-offs between attorneys that they're willing to toss the best interest of some clients that they perceive to be a lesser, not-so-important person, and they'll trade it off.
Yeah.
And then 2 years down the road, they'll flip and get some kind of a benefit later on. This use of judges who have no special expertise in homeowners associations or anything else or even real estate.
Yeah.
But they use them anyway. It's a favor to the judge. The person they appoint is a favor. The other drawback with using ADR is a lot of times, even if it's an attorney, the attorney demands so much work that you might as well just go to trial.
Yeah.
Because instead of mediation, where people show up and I know nothing about the case. I know nothing. Sometimes I don't even know their names. They come in and sit down and somebody tells me what it's about. It's not a paper-driven thing.
Yeah.
But in ADR, the attorneys want to move into that because it's a way of getting all the information and discovery from the other side so they can beat you at it later. They're never going to settle with you.
Yeah.
Plus, and I wanted to talk about personality. Personality. I have what I think are some unique theories and studies. The book goes far beyond the range of just legal treatises and citing cases and looking up law theories and doctrines. I try to group them into categories. For example, why people are denied the right to an appeal. The court has artificially created a number of doctrines that prevent people from, they can file, but they always get rejected for appeal. So whether you're a prisoner trying to get habeas corpus, or whether you're, as I was, an attorney who went through so many disciplinary processes, you can't get to your constitutional rights because the judges have made an artificial, it's like a corporation. It's an imaginary boundary to your getting into court. Now, I'm sorry, I have to question the legality of this. And I like always going back to the Constitution, which puts me outside of the standard values of many lawyers and judges. Richard Posner, premier dean from Harvard, has written the only other judge treatise book that I know of that exists in America. There are two treatises written by a variety of professors. University of Chicago has some. That have been written over 20 or 30 years, but I find that what they include and don't include in their book to be very telling. One of those early treatises on judge ethics, the one from the 80s, cited criminal acts of judges. So if a judge commits theft, robbery, breaking and entering, DWI, sex, all different kinds of sex. I've got a whole chapter on different kinds of sex, judge having sex with the clients, with the attorneys, with other people involved in the case, with each other. You know, it's kind of like rabbits.
It sounds like a fun place to be.
And with children.
Oh.
Pedophile judges.
Oh.
And incest judges. And if you don't believe me, I cite the cases. So you can go look it up. They're in the footnotes. That was covered in one of the premier ethics books about judges in the first version. But when I bought the second version that came out 15 years later, it's been purged of those. The crimes are missing. The burglary is missing. The theft by deceptive taking that, you know, the...
Really?
Shoplifting. Even the shoplifting has been eliminated. So it's been sanitized to make judges look good, even in their own ethics books. So there's another ethics book out there, and Judge Posner, at one point recently, within the last 2 months, gave an interview, and it was recorded in a magazine, where he talked about the Constitution is dead. It's not worthy of teaching to students or to adults. Judges should not be considering it for 1 week, 1 day, 1 hour, 1 minute, or 1 second in deciding their decisions. Now, you've got a shocked look on your face.
I'm absolutely horrified.
Sue, you are looking, and you're speechless.
I'm absolutely horrified because I keep remembering, I'm not an attorney, but I've sat in on a lot of court cases, and, you know, they say, oh, you don't even want to bring up the constitutionality of this. And, you know,
and that's where we're so naive as American citizens. How many times have your guests said, hey, this is America. They can't do that.
Yeah, yeah. Can they do that? In fact, in my opener, they say, can they do that?
You can't do that. So you have a prisoner, an innocent prisoner. What we're finding now is because of public policy that happened on a national level, but has filtered down to state levels, is we have an undue imbalance in courts that provide prosecutors with a lot of judge prerogatives. So prosecutors actually, and I have sections of the book where I talk about this, that they've taken over judging roles, and they have a disproportionate value. And so what we're seeing, when I started writing the book, I think about 95% of criminal cases in America were being plea bargained. It's now up to 99%. It went to 97.5%, and then when I checked again in 2015, just before this went to print, we were up to 97.5% from the national judicial statistics. And I have the citations for where I get my statistics. So these are national statistics put out by different judge groups. So what we see is a lot of Americans who are accused of crimes, and now there are more crimes than ever. I mean, what in the 80s wasn't a crime is, well, the lady selling apricots, for one, isn't a crime, is now a crime. But it's all across the board. The war on drugs increased the number of crimes we have across America, but we have lots of things that didn't used to be crimes. And now you have to catch up with that. So we have, my premise is that we have innocent people who are pleading guilty because of the system that prosecutors use of overcharging. So you have one perhaps alleged violation of an incident. I'll give you the one of a case of child abuse where the parents were charged over a 10-year period with what were alleged to be one incident of child abuse, but it ended up in 99 different allegations, criminal allegations. And I know both the parents ended up pleading guilty because they couldn't afford and weren't willing to put their family through. I hear cases like you do all the time, and it covers the whole spectrum. It's not just criminal cases. I don't give legal advice. But I wrote this book because I want people to be educated how to figure out their own cases. If you've been to court and you left impoverished, losing, lost your child, lost your house, lost your rights, lost your freedom, lost your reputation, you're exhausted, you're ill, you're so happy to have it over, but you lost, you lost your life. You lost your reputation.
Yeah.
But it feels wrong.
Yeah.
In your gut, you're thinking,
It is wrong.
This is the Constitution. I have a pocket Constitution here in my purse.
Yeah, it is.
This
wrong.
Is wrong.
It is wrong.
Then this book will help you deconstruct through homework assignments, or not, and through stories. And so I incorporate people's stories, including my own, to try to anchor legal theories, legal principles, and legal ideas into reality. Most treatises that you read across America, that's why law books are so dang expensive, but you buy, or attorneys buy them and judges buy them. They used to buy my old book. Now, I lost all those rights. I lost everything in my divorce from the ex-judge, ex-congressman, ex-ex-ex-ex, you know, former everything. And it was because of cronyism. And I've talked about that in the book, and I'm not doing it because, Carolyn, get a life, can't you get over it? I'm not doing it because I'm sour grapes. I'm doing it because it's the best teaching tool I know. So I have about 5 cases from some of my clients and some of the other ex-wives of judges. I use their cases as well. And I don't use them. It's not just limited to divorce. This is happening in every court across America. Not every case and not every hearing. But I'll tell you, it's so hard to be a good judge in America because there's no oversight and there's no incentive not to react to the cronyism, the pressure to fall to cronyism, whether you are a U.S. Supreme Court judge or whether you're a little traffic court judge or you're somewhere in between. The pressure to bow to cronyism is so strong that it's corrupted the system. But people don't understand how and why it happened, and so I detail it. There are 4 chapters on tricks you can look for before court happens, and then during trial, and then after trial, and then on appeal. And my frustration is that it seems like there's no place in America to go to get correction to errors and misconduct that happens, and there's no place. And we're Americans, and we say, look, I've got my constitution, I pay my taxes, I'm a good citizen, I don't jaywalk, I'm kind to people, I do this, I do that, how can this happen to me? And that's how I ended up writing this book.
Let me ask you something. I'm sitting here listening to you, and I'm thinking about everything you say. I hear from people. Again, I've never experienced this, so I can't tell you, yeah, I know how it feels. I don't. But I hear from people, and I know exactly what they're saying. I hear the same stories over and over again. Okay, so read the book and figure out what happened. But can you stop it? I mean, understanding why you're screwed and why you got thrown under the bus and why everything is so upside down and you're homeless and you're penniless and you hate the world and the world hates you. But what can you do about it? Is there some way you can stop
it? I went
it?
Through that frustration because yeah. I couldn't help the people that I loved and wanted to help. I yeah. couldn't help myself.
Yeah.
For gosh sakes, and I fought like crazy. I fought through probably 45 cases, almost 24 professional conduct cases, and 24 what I call slap suits.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, do you know what a slap suit is?
Oh, I certainly do. Yes, 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 yes.
I think one of your earlier guests, an attorney, talked about defending himself in 13 slap suits that were brought by homeowners. And every time he would win one, they would file another one,
yeah.
and they'd file another one. Well, yeah. I had that same thing. It's a litigation tactic.
Yes. Yes.
I kind of started out talking about personality, and then I dropped the ball on personality. But while we're talking about litigation tactics and why lawyers act the way they do, I wanted to talk about several studies that I found as I was doing research. And they were studies that were done in the 50s and 60s in Ivy League colleges, mostly of white males, and they're called conformity studies, and they're very famous. They're all over the internet, but I also talk about them on in my book several times, but then I apply them. The theory behind it is that while the rest of the world was doing peace movements and having sex, love, and
sticking flowers all over the place.
Sticking flowers all over the place, and the birth control pill was out, so everything it changed American society. There was a group of people in Ivy League schools that submitted to several tests. One of them was the Milgram studies. They had them at Yale. They had them at Stanford. Yale, Stanford, and Harvard, of course. And they were conformity studies. And what we found in those studies, and they're worthwhile, I think every American should know about them, is there is an incredibly high degree of conformity among this general population.
Yeah.
And it's
look
so
at how
high
we live. Look at how we live.
That in about 75% or 3 out of 4 white males in that age group, in that demographic, would know the right answer to a question, but would change their answer in order to be in conformity with 9 or 10 yeah. strangers.
Yeah, yeah.
Then there was that authoritarian study about the use of authority and power, and that was the Stanford study where they, for a week, they took a group of students who were paid, they answered an ad in the paper, and some of them were guards and some of them were prisoners. They stopped the study after 4 days because of the trauma that was happening.
Oh.
But it's what happens when people are given power without a lot of regulation and without oversight. I've extrapolated that and I've crossed it over with a Myers-Briggs study that I found from the University of Dayton that I thought was so interesting. This Myers-Briggs study found that, you know, there are 16 categories of personalities. But in law, 6 of the 16, many lawyers end up falling into six different personalities that like high authority, that like rational linear thinking. They think in a different pattern than most Americans. They lack creativity. They lack, not only do they lack helping skills, Shu, you obviously have helping skills. One, because you were in nursing, and two, because you've never even been in court. And yet for 17 years, you've been interviewing people who are in pain and who don't know where to go to get relief and who are looking for answers. You've got a helping person side. You would never be a judge or probably an attorney under the Myers-Briggs personality testing.
Probably not.
There are other kinds of testing. There's Enneagrams. There's a number of... So what I've tried to incorporate into my book are some sociological, psychological, and neurobiological scientific testing that indicates that we've ended up in the court system with an authoritarian personality that not only lacks in empathy, but believes that people who are kind or empathetic are actually lesser thinkers.
Yeah, stupid.
You got it.
Yeah, they're stupid.
That they're stupid and they look down on them.
Yeah, they do.
That when you can win, why wouldn't you just put the knife in?
Yeah.
So if that's true, judges and lawyers represent 1/100 of 1% of the population of the United States. It's footnote 2 in my book. The statistics are there from 2015, U.S. Census. 1%, 1/10 of 1%. So 99.999% of Americans are not lawyers and judges. But what we have is this personality type that's taken over this monopoly. Of course they would create a monopoly because they can, and they did it in secret, and they did it using wiles and illegitimate methods, at least in New Hampshire. I only deconstruct New Hampshire. And I do it in a homework assignment that has back shading on it, so you recognize it as a homework assignment. It may be tedious. I didn't find it tedious because when you get to the end, you see how the judges were able to evade specific language in the state constitution that prohibited monopolies and prohibited restraint on trade. And that's the citation they used in their opinion to justify a monopoly in the state bar. After they got control of the state bar and the licensing, remember that was my original first job as a lawyer, is this regulation of people. After they got control of regulation of people, then lots of other regulations and lots of other processes go into effect. And now we are 40 or 50 years later, and what I'm seeing is rampant corruption throughout the entire system. So even if you do have people who somehow have gotten through the admissions process and have an interest in going to law school, if you read the chapters on how law schools teach and why, they're teaching to a financial formula. So they're not teaching black letter law. They're not teaching the Constitution. They're not teaching old case laws. They're teaching argumentative style behavior that's consistent with this personality type that wants to argue ad nauseum. So you end up in court with whoever gets the last word, and they argue. It's having been married to someone with that strong personality type, that strong judge personality type that fits the mold, it's difficult.
Relationships. I can imagine.
You don't find ballerinas in court. You don't find artists being judges. You don't find football players or creative people or caring people. Those are not the kinds of people that are getting either nominated. Well, they work to get nominated, and I have chapters on that and sections on that. Either nominated or elected to judge. If they aspire to be a judge, you can look for certain personality traits. Now, this doesn't mean that there aren't some caring judges out there.
I've actually seen some.
I wrote about some. Constance Sweeney, I gave her kudos in it. Judge Macias down in Las Cruces. There are people that are judges, but they're few and far between.
Yeah,
but I've tried to name them in my book because I felt like, oh, my gosh, all I'm doing
is putting them down and there are some good ones.
And I didn't write the book to nominate good judges. I would love to hear people's nominations for good and caring judges, but they don't fit the personality mold that has taken over the third branch of government.
Yeah.
Because it's a secret branch, and because it operates, it's such a small branch. It kind of has gotten away with this for about 4 or 5 generations. 4 score and 20? Would that be right?
4 score and 20, yeah.
About that many years. They've gotten away with it until now. If you're an individual, if you're a tiny person like me going to court, I mean, you sit back and you're so beaten up in court.
Yeah.
And you're at such a loss.
Yeah.
And you don't know what to do about it, and you keep running around saying to people, "Shoo, help me.
Yeah.
Caroline, help me.
Yeah.
Someone, help me.
Yeah.
What happened? What happened?"
Yeah.
I can't help you.
Yeah.
But I can educate you. I can educate our country. And that was my goal in writing this book, is I'm looking to form roughly 500 study groups across the country. People who can get together and read this and discuss for themselves their own opinions. They may think that I'm, you know, just a sour grapes, disgruntled woman. And that's their right.
You're not, because I've heard from a lot of people and attorneys as well. So, yeah.
But if they could get together and discuss this, it's only an 8-chapter book, although it
only
is.
It's like carrying a newborn around, one that slips down. Yeah.
I know. One person said, "My gosh, this book's going to give me a hernia." All right.
But
so,
the bits that I have.
So
right,
it's a little heavy, you know.
But no, it's a nice
But book. I do think it has answers. It doesn't have the ultimate answer. I hope candidates read it. I wish the U.S. senators would read it. I think that there are answers out there by people who are much smarter than I am. But what I'm trying to do is empower them to think outside the box and to stand back and do an assessment of a branch of government that never, ever gets assessed.
I think that's a great idea. I like that idea. I've wondered sometimes, because if you look... The layperson like myself thinks that, all right, if you've got an attorney who's really bad, they go in front of the Bar Association, and the Bar Association is going to self-police them, right?
Huh.
Wrong. Very funny. It's like any time you have any self-policing, it's not going to happen. It becomes a personality issue.
Well, it's the disease of cronyism.
It becomes a personality issue. I don't like this person, therefore we'll throw the book at them. We'll despise them, but I like this person. I don't care.
It's also a system of favor trading. I call it a country club.
It's
favor trading among members. Even members who don't like each other may give a bad attorney a pass.
Yes.
For a variety of reasons completely unrelated to the facts in the complaint. And the same thing with the judge conduct
that.
Committees.
Yeah, I've seen
And how
that.
They operate on a practical level. So you get some behind-the-scenes information in my book, because people gave me lots of hints and tips. The chairman of the New Hampshire Judicial Conduct Committee, the year all the judges in the Supreme Court were investigated by the House for impeachment.
Wow.
And turned over to the Senate for impeachment. That chairman, I mean, ended up giving me all kinds of detail about the Judicial Conduct Committee, which I thought I knew, but I needed confirmation. So what I tried to do as I wrote the book, like any investigative journalist would do, or any legal treatise writer would do, is I tried to cite, and I tried to cite, and I tried to reference cases that were already in print, that weren't just rumors that had been floated by me, the rumors I had to disregard, as wonderful as I thought they were, because I couldn't verify them.
Carolyn, we're out of time. I hate to do this to you, but I want you to, first of all, the book is called The Dark Side, A Law Treatise on Judging with
Memoir.
And I'm looking forward to reading it. How can people reach you? Can people reach you?
People can reach me through Gmail. It's Caroline G. Douglas. CaroLineG Douglas at gmail.com, or sure, they can always call you.
They can always call me, and I will send them over to you. Carolyn, would you promise to come back? Because I think we've just scratched the surface.
And yet this wasn't your main focus, but I think that it touches on everything that your HOA listeners
complain about. It is.
And it may give them some insight.
Thank you so much.
Please check out our website at onthecommons.us. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to Justice 4HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Well, we're not afraid or stupid, all your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone, united we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine, and enjoy those precious golden years, stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.